Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, in moments, Lee Drutman will talk about lobbying, who does it and why. And then at the bottom of the hour, economist Josh Bivens will talk about the Fed's asset purchasing program, a.k.a. quantitative easing. Did it work and did it make the rich richer? First, Lee Drutman. Drutman is a political scientist who studies power and influence. He is a senior fellow at New America and an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University. His book, The Business of America is Lobbying, How Corporations Became Politicized and Politics Became Corporate, is just out from Oxford University Press. We all hear about lobbyists working their way with Congress, but how did this happen, and what exactly do they do? Of the 100 organizations that spend the most on lobbying, 95 represent business interests, a gaggle of influence peddlers who gather on and around K Street in Washington, a location name that has become shorthand for the whole racket, just like Wall Street means finance. And business interests are not known for spending money if there's nothing in it for them. In historical time, though, this is a relatively recent innovation, only about 40 years old. Drutman has read lots of documents and interviewed lots of lobbyists to tell us how it all works. Lee Drutman. Welcome, Lee. So let's start with a definition. What exactly is lobbying in your usage?
I think of lobbying pretty broadly as all attempts to influence public policy. Include what is the definition of lobbying under the Lobbying Disclosure Act, which is what gets reported, which is direct contacting of members of Congress and their staff and government agencies, as well as the preparation that goes into that. I want to think more broadly about lobbying, as well as the sort of lobbying the media, getting think tanks and other research organizations to produce reports, building relationships generally. So just kind of everything that goes into trying to influence public policy.
And of course, what most people are interested in is big money in politics, big business, Wall Street, those sorts of interests. I mean, it's hard to object to, you know, citizens trying to lobby the government as what democracy is supposed to be. But it gets a little fishy when big money starts getting in. Is that that's the issue we're talking about?
Well, certainly when you look at the spending on lobbying, most of it is indeed business lobbying. About 80% of the reported money is business lobbying. It's individual companies, it's trade associations. Whereas very little of it is citizen lobbies. In fact, when you tally all the money on behalf of citizen groups, diffuse interest, public interest groups, and unions, which represent broad groups, and you might think of those as the countervailing force to business, and then you tally up all the business lobbying, you get $1 for every for the citizens and the labor unions combined, and that compared to $34 for businesses combined. And by the way, that ratio has been increasing over time. In 1998, it was 22-1. That's as far as I can go back. Now it's 34-1. So it's just this incredible imbalance of who is there every day in the halls of Congress, in the agencies, talking to lawmakers and their staffs about what public policy ought to be.
Who does it? What companies are involved? And what's the balance between individual firms and trade associations?
Well, it's pretty much all the big name firms that you can think of. Biggest individual companies these days are Comcast and Google are at the top, General Electric, Boeing, a lot of big defense contracts, a lot of big pharmaceutical companies, the banks are up there as well, but it's pretty much everyone. What's happened is that over time, it used to be prior to the 1970s, it was pretty much all trade associations. Then in the 1970s, a lot of individual businesses were awakened to engage in political activity. They felt threatened by the growth in government regulation. They hired their own lobbyists. And since then, the balance has been shifting more and more towards individual companies having their own lobbyists. In fact, the biggest companies now have upwards of 100 of their own lobbyists in Washington.
And what are their targets? Who are their targets? Congress, the public, regulatory bodies? Who are the targets of the lobbyists?
All of the above. They spend a lot of time lobbying Congress. They spend a lot of time lobbying the regulatory agencies. Indirectly, they try to shape public opinion through running advertisements, through working through the media, through shaping research and the intellectual environment. That is how we all think about public policy, especially folks in Washington. So it's pretty much everything. But the bulk of it is at the government decision makers themselves.
And how much money do companies spend on this sort of thing? It's a small portion of their overall budgets, isn't it?
Sure. So when we tally up, this is again reported lobbying. It's about $2.6 billion is what corporations spend, which again is, as you know, is peanuts for a lot of these big companies, right? So Google, Comcast spending $20 million a year. That's like a rounding error on their daily market capitalization. But it's big money in Washington because $2.6 billion. Is a lot of money when you think about the fact that the budget for the entire House and the entire Senate combined is $2 billion.
Yes, politicians come pretty cheap, don't they?
Well, you know, you may have heard the saying in Washington that we have the best Congress that money can buy, although actually I think it's the opposite. We've been doing government on the cheap for a long time, and we get what we pay for. People in Congress don't make a lot of money, especially the staff, and what happens is you pay staff not very well. You expect them to do an incredible amount of work in cramped quarters. And they burn out. They don't stay for that long. And instead, a lot of them go on and become lobbyists. So you have this situation where Congress is run by a bunch of very smart and energetic but not very experienced 20-year-olds. And they have to turn to lobbyists to help them to draft laws and understand what the policy should be and how to get it passed. And so basically you have lobbyists writing the laws in Congress. Because we've decided that we don't believe in having a Congress that can hire the smartest and brightest people and keep them.
Yeah, that's an aspect I hadn't really thought about until I read your book, that the lobbying structure is a great talent drain. There's a brain drain out of Congress and into K Street because Congress pays so poorly and K Street pays so well. We're really getting worse quality of staff in government as a result.
Yeah, that is exactly right. We've basically decided that we're going to outsource policymaking to the private sector. And because lobbying is incredibly imbalanced, again, for every $1 labor unions and public interest groups combined spend on lobbying, corporations spend $34. We're basically relying on large businesses to write legislation, and I'm not particularly happy with that situation, and I suspect very few people are, except for the people who run large corporations.
And, of course, you know, there's certainly a sinister self-interested aspect of that, but also this is where a lot of the expertise is. If staffers come and go a matter of a couple of years, then they really don't develop much in the way of technical expertise or legal expertise, and then the lobbyists can move right in.
That's exactly right. And over time, things have become incredibly complicated. Pick any policy area that you care about and you start wading into the law, and it is very, very complicated and intentionally so, right? So if you think about the tax code, which is a great example, the thing is 3.8 million words long, which, by the way, is 6.5 times the length of War and Peace. And it gets progressively longer and longer each year. In 1986, passed a major tax reform bill, simplified it. Between 1986 and 2005, a report found 15,000 affirmative changes to the tax code. And these are mostly put in there by lobbyists, and they're intentionally drafted to be complicated so that if you just sat and started reading it, you wouldn't know what the heck it means. You need experts, and there are a lot of tax lobbying and law experts in Washington who make a business on the thing being complicated. People have to rely on them, including the companies, by the way, that hire them don't understand it themselves. So really, it's the lobbyists who are doing best of all. A lot of lobbying is probably wasted. But as companies who hire the lobbyists, they don't understand Washington, so they don't know what bit of it is wasted. All they know is that occasionally it works, and it works occasionally enough to justify the ever increasing costs of it.
This gets a little arcane, but is there a principal agent issue where the lobbyists start developing interests of their own separate from their employers?
I think that is, it may be arcane, but I think it's actually what's driving a lot of the growth in lobbying is that once companies hire lobbyists, those lobbyists have a very strong interest in retaining those companies as their clients. And once they set up government affairs shops, those in-house lobbyists have a very strong incentive in making sure they have a job and they're growing and they're getting more money. So lobbyists keep coming up with policies to get the companies lobbying on issues that the company should care about. They're trying to look ahead, well, what's going to be in the future. So over time, lobbying has, when companies didn't really have lobbyists, their political action was very reactive. It was sparse. Once they have lobbyists, lobbying becomes more proactive, more aggressive. And another key point is that it becomes more particularistic, right? Because the lobbyists want to make sure that the companies hire their own lobbyists, not that they just pay dues to the trade association, which will represent the industry, but that the companies have their own particularistic interest, which makes it so that, you know, it's not just that the banking industry is going to lobby, it's that Goldman Sachs has their own unique interest, and that's how things, regulations in particular get so complicated. If you think about financial regulation, we had, as part of Dodd-Frank, we had 400 rules being made. Take one of them, which was particularly controversial, the Volcker rule, which was supposed to eliminate proprietary trading. It started out as 10 pages in the Dodd-Frank bill. By the time the Fed was finished making the rule, it had gotten to be 953 pages. No bright lines, plenty of loopholes, impossible to enforce. Why? Because all the individual banks put in their particular pieces. And you can multiply that out across any number of policy areas.
It's funny, you hear sometimes people say unintended consequences of legislation, but it does seem like some of those consequences are intended by somebody. We just didn't notice it at the time.
Well, unintended consequences is a way is a way in which business lobbyists try to take advantage of the inexperience of members of Congress and their staff, and they say, well, you don't understand what's going to happen. But basically, subtext is, you're dumb, we're the experts. If you do this, you will somehow blow up the economy. You don't understand what you're doing. So it's sometimes an effective argument, but often you're right that when they're dealing with particular pieces, they know exactly what they're trying to achieve.
I'm speaking with Lee Drutman, who is a fellow at the New America Foundation and author of The Business of America is Lobbying, just out from Oxford University Press. Let's go back and talk some of the history. When did modern lobbying get going? Sometime in the 70s?
I would say in the 1970s. In the 1960s, corporate lobbying was pretty sparse. Very few companies had offices in Washington. And so in the 1960s, somebody like Ralph Nader could come along, write a book about automobile safety, and a year later we had the creation of the Department of Transportation, and in fact in the late 60s and the early 70s there was sort of this incredible growth in the ability of government to deal with a whole range of social, environmental, safety problems, creation of a bunch of new regulatory agencies. Now by the early 1970s, business community was in a bit of a state of existential shock. They really didn't know what had hit them, and they had sort of not been involved in politics. Lobbying was not something that they really did, but they got together. The leading CEOs formed the Business Roundtable. The Chamber of Commerce was reinvigorated, and the modern lobbying business essentially took off as there were more and more high-paying clients, more and more people went into lobbying. Lobbying became more competitive, therefore lobbyists had to invent new approaches to stand out. And over time, you've seen a steady ratcheting up of that to the point that we are today, where just lobbying, particularly corporate lobbying, has really overwhelmed Washington. And there's far more lobbyists than there are members of Congress.
If we go back into the 70s, the original lobbying that got going was very broadly political. It was about rolling back social regulations and economic regulations, changing the tax code, and you know, the time of the Powell memo in the early 70s, a sense that business was under siege in politics and culture more broadly. And then as time went on, the lobbying got more and more narrow, didn't it?
Yeah, well, one of the things that happened was that business won. Right. So by the time Reagan was in the White House, they had brought their taxes down considerably. They had put cost-benefit analysis into the White House. They had killed labor law reform and just generally changed the culture of regulation in Washington. So now you're sort of at this moment where the business community can say, okay, well, we've accomplished what we wanted to accomplish, so we can now stop playing politics. But now you see they had all these lobbyists, and the lobbyists kept saying, well, okay, here we've won that, but now here are all these other things that we can do, and here's ways we can get we can work on trade policy and get tariffs or protection, or here's specific tweaks we can make the tax code, or here are particular regulations, or just things get as the lobbyists have to invent reasons to stay in Washington, they look for more and more narrow policy changes that they can justify.
The situation in D.C. where, you know, gridlock rules, no one can get anything done, and people lament that, but they're actually that benefits business interests to some degree, doesn't it?
Well, if you think that the status quo benefits business, then I do believe that it does, right? So sometimes getting nothing done is actually the optimal policy. So you think about all the energy companies that don't want the government to do anything on climate. Status quo gridlock, very good for them. You think about all the wealthy hedge fund people who don't want the Congress to do anything on carried interest. Gridlock, very good for them. So you look at any policy, you look at pharmaceutical companies that are making incredible money from very generous patent law. Patent reform, they don't want it. Gridlock, great for them.
But then, you know, you see something like a couple of years ago when the government looked like it was on the verge of defaulting. We had a government shutdown. You would think that business interests would be nervous about that. Firstly, you know, we want to protect the sanctity of the Treasury bond market, but more broadly, it looks to have the United States government shutting down and looking fairly dysfunctional is very disruptive, one would think. But business interests really didn't get off their butts during those times. Why not?
Well, it's certainly true that business was upset about this, but there's a simple reason that they didn't lobby, that they hadn't lobbied on this issue, was because it's a business-wide issue, and they're all looking out for their own narrow interests. So business very rarely lobbies as a whole in kind of a what's good for the entire economy way. Even the Chamber of Commerce doesn't really do this, but that was a what's good for the entire economy issue, and it's just not something that individual companies or associations really have tended to lobby on. And so when it came to that moment, they were not really prepared and hadn't laid the groundwork for that kind of lobbying.
But now 40 years earlier when they got going, they were doing precisely that sort of thing, very broad political issues. And then now has success spoiled them?
Well, I think success has fractured them. In a sense, when there was a lot at stake, it was very easy to unify, right? They felt like they were up against big government and big labor. But once you don't have a common enemy, the efforts become more diffuse. Business spends a lot of time fighting business. There's not a sense of business organized as a responsible class. I mean, it used to be that the leading business organization was an organization called the Committee for Economic Development, which still exists. It's a shadow of its former self. But it was a pretty progressive business organization. It took the idea of corporate statesmanship seriously. Guys like Thomas J. Watson of IBM who said, look, we accept government's role in the economy, and we want to work productively with government for a more progressive state. Those kinds of corporate statesmen don't really exist anymore.
Well, that the CED had made peace with the New Deal to some degree, and then the business lobbyists that came of age in the 70s were out to undo it.
Yeah, that is basically the story, that there was a different class of business organizations like the Business Roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce, which had been a much more marginal organization. National Association of Manufacturers became a much more active presence. National Federation of Independent Businesses, NFIB, became a much more active presence. And this was just a different kind of organization with a different kind of political orientation. In addition, you starting in the 90s, you had a very different type of person running companies. It was a much, much more concern on shareholder value, which meant much more concern about short-term profits. And it became about getting rich now, not thinking about what's good for the long term, not planning for the long term, not having the whole of society, but it's just how much money can I get out of government? How can public policy benefit my company in particular, give me more profits now? And that directs a very, very different type of lobbying.
Has that new consciousness undermined the trade association in favor of more individual firm lobbying?
Yeah, I think it has. In addition to as companies put their own lobbyists into Washington, those lobbyists then fight each other in the trade associations. Trade associations have always been uneasy alliances between companies that are competitors but sort of cooperators. So I think it has undermined the trade association because as companies, as industries become more competitive within the industry, it's much harder for the entire association to reach an agreement. So what they do is they lobby on what they call least common denominator issues. Companies within the spend a lot of time fighting each other within the associations. Sometimes that immobilizes the associations. The associations still exist because everybody wants to pay dues to be there to try to shape the direction of the association, but what happens is that more and more of the lobbying is at the company, not the association level.
What about the division between in-house lobbyists and hired hands? Are the figures like Charles Walker, who were so big in the 70s and 80s, still big in Washington, or is it more in-house guys now?
Well, certainly the larger companies have more and more of their own in-house staff because they have more and more permanent presence, but there are certainly, there's just been a growth of everything in lobbying. So there's a lot more of the hired hands as well. A lot of members of Congress go out and set up shop as lobbyists. Not all of them register, like Tom Daschle or Newt Gingrich. So that has certainly expanded. It's really just been an expansion on all fronts and in all directions.
Yeah, Denny Hastert in the news. I was surprised by how much that guy could make in such a short period of time. But I guess pretty much anybody who's been through Congress can get a pretty lucrative post on K Street.
Sure, right. People are paying for the door opening access of a former member of Congress, particularly somebody who's in the leadership like Hastert. So I easily can pull in $2-3 million a year. Companies are willing to pay that. Whether or not he actually is doing all that much is unclear, but he certainly understands the people, he understands the process, and he knows when to make the phone calls, and his phone calls do get returned.
What about some of the tech firms? They're come out of a pretty, many of them are very libertarian in their ideology, their philosophy, and hostile to government, but have they learned to play the game?
Well, they certainly have. Google is now one of the leading spenders on lobbying in Washington. Facebook is increasing its presence rapidly. So the first one to really set up a big presence in Washington, of course, was Microsoft after it got slammed with a lawsuit, antitrust lawsuit from the Justice Department in 98. You see the company just really go from a handful of lobbyists to like 20 or 30 lobbyists in Washington and never really look back. And when I talked to folks in the tech industry doing research, I interviewed a lot of lobbyists for this book, they all said, well, we all learned from the Microsoft example that you can't ignore Washington. And it was a cultural shift because, you know, as I'll give you a quote from one lobbyist, tech industry. It's 25 years ago, our companies were run by engineers, and it was just keep the government out of our business. We want to do what we want to do. And gradually that's changed to how can we make the government our partners? It's gone from leave us alone to let's work on this together. And if there's one line that I think summarizes the transformation of corporate lobbying, it's that from leave us alone to let's work on this together. That once these companies see that government is important to their business, they realize that they can't have this adversarial relationship, that they have to work on things with government, not against government. And you see that again and again. Government will purchase their goods. Government will help them to set up regulations. It's, you know, they don't always win, but there's a lot at stake.
It's funny when you use that phrase work with. I get that from publicists who want their clients on my radio show. They want me to tell their stories. Work with me means help me out, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Let's work on this together.
Yes. Okay. Finally, is there a way to get this under control? Assuming people wanted to get it under control.
I believe that what we need to do is we need to invest in government again. We have now a third fewer committee staff in Congress than we had in 1980. The world has become a lot more complicated. The amount of lobbying has grown exponentially, and demands on from constituent service. So we need to think seriously if Congress is going to be able to resist the influence of all this lobbying, they need their own expertise. They need their own independence. We need to make Congress a place that hires and retains the best people. We need to beef up the independent research agencies within Congress, like the Congressional Research Service and the GAO. We need to bring back institutional capacity, or else the lobbyists will continue to write the laws. I also think that we need to get our campaign finance system under control, and we also need to do something to support citizen lobbying organizations that have just been totally overwhelmed by corporate lobbying organizations. But I think the number one thing is that we need to take investment in government seriously.
Of course, lobbyists will hear that and say, we do everything we can to prevent that. But also, it just made me think, do people in Congress think, well, how can I handle my career in Congress to maximize my earning power when I retire? Do they think that? Does it affect the way they act and vote?
It may. I think one of the things that you notice about Congress now is that people go into it mostly who are very rich in the first place, because those are the people who have rich friends who can help them get elected. But, you know, look, I think we should pay members of Congress more. There's this idea that these people in Washington are not doing anything and they're living high on the hog. Member of Congress makes $174,000. That's a nice salary, but that's like pennies of what a CEO makes at a big company. It's like what a first-year law associate makes in Washington, basically. It's not a lot of money. Top staff maybe make low six figures. It's not a lot of money in Washington. So, again, you get what you pay for. And I think if you give people more money, then they're less worried about, like, how can I transition into being a lobbyist, and they're more focused on the job that they're doing. We spend 0.06% of the federal budget on Congress. It's a tiny, tiny fraction to oversee the entire rest of the government. Think of all the wasteful spending programs at the Pentagon, right? I mean, it's just idiocy.
I was Lee Drutman, a senior fellow at New America and author of The Business of America is Lobbying, How Corporations Became Politicized and Politics Became Corporate, just out from Oxford University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henward in the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of For the Love of Money by Defunct from 1980. Next, Josh Bibbins, the research director of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. There's been a lot of controversy over the Federal Reserve's unorthodox monetary policies ever since the Great Recession, namely its large-scale asset purchases, aka quantitative easing. In normal times, after normal recessions, the Fed and other central banks typically cut interest rates to stimulate an economic recovery. After a collapse of the sort that we saw in 2008, the Fed cut short-term rates to zero with little apparent effect. In a departure from that normal practice, it began buying gobs of U.S. Treasury bonds and other federally guaranteed debt like those of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The program ran from late 2008 through October 2014, with the Fed eventually buying something like $4 trillion in securities. That kept long-term interest rates down, but it's not clear just how much that stimulated the economy. But with fiscal policy deeply in austerity mode, it was the only stimulative game in town. Even if it was only modestly stimulative, it was probably better than nothing. However, there's a big question around whether it was a giant giveaway to the rich by stimulating financial markets a lot more than it did the real economy. In a presentation at the Brookings Institution the other day, Josh Bivens argued that it wasn't such a giveaway and was significantly better than nothing. Here he is to talk about that and some general economic issues as well. Josh Bivens.
There are a lot of people who think that the Fed's large-scale asset purchases or quantitative easing, whatever you want to call it, was a gift to the wealthy at the expense of everyone else. So you don't see it quite that way, do you?
I don't. I think there were sort of two effects of QE and the large-scale asset purchases. I mean, one, there was a mechanical effect in it pushed up asset prices. I think one thing that's important to remember there is that housing is an asset, and it's a pretty broadly held one. And then the much more important point is I think you have to take into account what those asset purchases did for the state of the overall economy. And if they put downward pressure on overall unemployment at all, that's an incredibly progressive thing. Low rates of unemployment provide really disproportionate benefits to low and moderate wage workers.
So how much of an impact are we talking about? I've seen estimates that are kind of all over the place, but most people say it's modest but not extraordinary.
That's about where I am. So totally or very uncertain effects. I think that the direction I'm entirely convinced is in the right direction. I think unemployment is lower than it would have otherwise been had the Fed not done the QE programs. I don't think the effects were extraordinarily large. Like I've seen effects of about at its peak, it lowered unemployment by a percentage point relative to what would happen otherwise. That strikes me as it's plausible. It's still, you know, a much smaller effect than, say, what would be inferred from fiscal policy measures like the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. So I think, you know, modest and uncertain is a good description of them. I think the direction was clearly in the right direction, though.
Well, we're talking about an effect of maybe 1% on the unemployment rate for what, something in the order of $4 trillion of asset purchases. So not much bang for the buck there.
Yeah, that's right. So there's two things here. One, I'm pretty sanguine about the effects of the Fed policies on, because my counterfactual baseline is if the Fed had not done QE and LSEP, nobody else would have done anything to sort of help speed the recovery and push unemployment down. If you say, instead of the Fed having done all that, what if we instead done aggressive fiscal policy to push unemployment down? I would be much more in favor of having done that aggressive fiscal policy. So I'm taking as given that the Congress was just doing nothing but destructive stuff on the economy, and so that's why I'm relatively favorably disposed to what the Fed did.
In the presentation you did at Brookings, you showed a pretty dramatic chart of the course of fiscal policy over the last several years and compared it to earlier cycles. Give us the summary of that.
Yeah, it's really striking, and it's underappreciated how historically austere spending in the current recovery has been relative to historic ones. If you basically take the average of the 1980s, 1990s, and early 2000s recovery, and you say, what if we had just allowed government spending to follow the average track we followed after those? I mean, we would have spending levels something like $700 billion higher today, and we would absolutely be at something like full employment. Basically, real government spending, you know, inflation adjusted, has been flat for almost 3 years. I mean, that is extraordinarily austere in a growing economy. And if you want to know why has it taken so long, why are we not recovered today, what explains why recovery has been so slow, the answer is entirely because of the fiscal austerity that we've embraced really since 2011, like the first year of the recession, 2009, and then even into 2010, we were doing okay in fiscal policy. And then after the Budget Control Act kicked in, really underrated how austere the American experience has been.
And this is just federal. That's been redoubled by state and local austerity, hasn't it?
It looks the same either way. If you include the state and local, you get the same trajectory in terms of how bad we look relative to current recoveries. But yes, if you include the state and local, then the overall drag from the fiscal austerity has been worse. I will say the state and local have so little room to operate that I feel like the linchpin is entirely federal decisions. I mean, the only way that state and local, well, that's not quite true. state and local governments could have raised taxes and could have raised progressive taxes to keep spending up. They are more constrained than the federal government, so I think it's really been the federal austerity that is the mammoth policy blunder. The state and local, you know, that's a little more mixed. There definitely have been some states that could have done more and relied way too heavily on the spending, but to me, the real sin is what we did at the federal level.
What kind of federal spending has been under constraint? Which programs?
Pretty much the entire discretionary side of the budget. There's actually been some defense cutbacks, but also the non-defense discretionary, which is basically everything that is not Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, has really been feeling the squeeze. And so that's including the employment of, you know, just direct federal employees. We've seen reductions in federal headcount, but then grants to state and local governments to do investment in their infrastructure. So sort of across the board in the discretionary categories.
I recall when Bernanke was rolling out all these unconventional monetary policies, he would give speeches that spoke rather eloquently of the sufferings of unemployment. He was saying things that no elected officials were saying at that point. It's remarkable how little attention has been paid to the pains of unemployment by people who are supposedly, you know, answerable to the electorate. And here's this guy running the top central banker who is actually sounding more humane than a lot of people who face electorates.
Yeah, I agree with that. And also Bernanke and then Yellen afterwards, Fed chairs are often sort of characterized as speaking very delphically and in very hard to interpret. And sometimes that's true. But when it comes to the impact of Congress's decisions on the recovery, both Bernanke and Yellen have been really pretty clear. I mean, just phrases like fiscal policy has been a serious drag on the recovery just sort of appear all over lots of their public statements, which I interpret as, you know, almost begging Congress to make the Fed's job a little easier in terms of returning to the economy to something closer to full employment. And I definitely think, you know, there's debate over the fiscal cliff at the beginning of 2013. There's, you know, tax cuts that were going to expire, and there were some spending cuts that were set to kick in, and there was much concern about that. And I think concern over the fiscal cliff was a big reason why we ended up getting the third round of quantitative easing. I think the fact that fiscal policy has been such a heavy drag on growth has been part of why the Fed has been doing pretty extraordinary things over the course of the recovery.
What were the mechanisms by which the asset purchases influenced the real economy, do you think?
I think a couple things. I mean, one, I definitely think there's been a refinancing channel. I mean, I know myself, I've refinanced, I think, twice since 2010 when we bought a house. Lower interest rates let people refinance their mortgages, and that frees up some resources for them to spend elsewhere or pay down debt. I think that's a big one. I think there is a small wealth effect, you know, both higher stock prices and higher housing prices. And when I say higher, I just mean higher relative to a non-QE world. Housing prices haven't risen much, but I think they probably would have not risen at all, even fallen further if the asset purchases weren't done. But I think there's been some wealth effect. And then I do think there has been some downward pressure on long-term interest rates that has filtered through to lower mortgage rates and lower credit card rates that has given people some more room to spend.
And now the distributional effects. A lot of people think that it's been a gift to the stock market. The stock market has been very strong. Since stock ownership is very concentrated at the upper end, this has been a gift to the proverbial 1%. What do you say to that?
I think there's a little to that. I think it's been a much smaller gift than is sort of popularly characterized. I think so. I do think that the asset purchases in QE probably have boosted stock prices. If you look at the sort of empirical research on it, it's I think less than people generally characterize. I have about a 5 to 10% increase in equity prices because of QE, which is not nothing. The stock market is a lot of wealth, so 5 or 10% isn't nothing. I do think people have in their head, you know, the stock market has risen enormously since its trough in 2010. But I think a lot of that is just bounce back from the 40% fall during the crisis. And so I think QE only has quite a bit smaller part to play in that. But no, I think all else equal, stock price is definitely higher because of QE. And so in that regards, they exacerbate inequality. I think the other asset price effect, which is probably even a little stronger, though, is on house prices, which are much more democratically held form of wealth.
And what do you think the QE has done to the housing market?
About the same. I think a little higher. I would say the estimates I saw in the research sort of span 7 to 15% higher home prices, and so a little bit bigger boost than stock prices. And the other thing, I guess another reason why I'm a little more sanguine about the distributional effects than some people, I think they're very temporary. I mean, eventually, one imagines, and the plan is surely for the asset purchases to be unwound. So as the Fed is buying lots of assets, it's putting some upward pressure on asset prices. But then at some point in the future when the economy is healthier, one imagines they're going to unwind that and they're actually going to start selling some assets, and that's going to depress prices. And so, you know, if you're talking about holding a bundle of stocks and just holding onto it over the entire winding and unwinding of quantitative easing, that there should be, you know, pretty neutral effects at the end.
I'm speaking with Josh Bibbins, who is the research director at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Yeah, this unwinding is going to be an interesting problem. I guess we're now looking to the September meeting, the FOMC, before they start tightening the screws a little bit, very slowly, very slightly. But with fiscal policy likely to remain pretty tight indefinitely, what do you see the undoing of all these asset purchases going to? What are the real world effects of that going to be?
You know, it's a good question, and it's a little unknown, and it depends on how quickly they decide to do it. So I would say you're right. September does seem to be a day where a lot of people start expecting some kind of monetary tightening to happen. I think most people are assuming that it's going to be a rise in sort of the federal funds rate and the short-term policy rates before they start unwinding the stock of assets they've purchased. I think that's too soon. I mean, I would definitely like to see a economy much closer to full employment before the Fed started tapping the brake at all. I think if they waited, you know, that there's some, you know, the first quarter of this year had some pretty rough data, but over the past year, there was some okay data on the economy in terms of going in the right direction, in terms of unemployment being lower and 3 million jobs created in 2014. And so I think if the Fed would hold off tightening, and if that momentum continued, you could imagine the unwinding the asset purchases in a much healthier economy a year and a half, 2-3 years from now, would put some downward pressure on asset prices, but would not do all that much to slow real economic growth. If they do any of this prematurely, I think the economy is still really fragile, and I think they could find the real economy slowing quite a bit, and then they'd be sort of forced to stop or even kind of reverse the contraction, which would be probably would cause really weird financial market effects if the Fed really starts going into a stop-go in terms of their overall stance.
I saw some remarks from the president of the Boston Fed, whose name now escapes me, the other day, who's one of the more dovish members of the Federal Reserve System. But he's saying that people who are looking to unwinding the asset purchases is having a moderate effect if drawn out over time, maybe underestimating the degree to which there's been some real structural changes after the Great Recession, and that the effects could be nastier than we think. And I think one of those structural changes is that people seem to be very cautious about spending. You know, income growth, not great, but reasonably strong, but some retail spending has been weak. People seem to be very cautious. Gas prices down, they're not spending that. What do you make of this argument?
It's a good so I haven't heard that particular one or that particular speech. I've heard the general idea that I guess I disagree a little if you look at the data that U.S. consumers seem all that cautious. I mean, there's been a recent increase in the savings rate, which explains some of the soft economic performance in the first quarter. But over the past 3 years or so, the personal savings rate has actually been declining, and it actually in 2013 and 2014 it reached levels that actually looked kind of like the mid-2000s when the housing bubble was ramping up. So the idea that there's some particular caution on the part of U.S. consumers, it's going to be really tough to overcome, that I haven't really seen it in the data yet. They may be very, you know, I guess you could make the case that they're going to be much more sensitive to any small change that looks like the economy is softening, and they might really whipsaw their spending down in response to anything that looks like a shock. But the trend of the savings rate over the recovery has been U.S. consumers looking pretty confident to me. So Yeah, that one I guess I'm not quite as worried about.
What do you think generally of the state of the labor market? And by some conventional indicators, you know, we're close to full employment. We've got a 5.5% unemployment rate. That's supposed to be, you know, in some eyes, that's the long-term safe number. Do we see some job growth yet? Things not so. We're not seeing any wage growth to speak of. What's your diagnosis of the beast overall?
Yeah, I think overall, I believe the wage numbers, which really say we're far from anything like full employment. I would say one of the more sensible things the Fed has done recently is they ratcheted down their estimate of the natural rate of unemployment. It basically was at 5.4%, and then as we essentially got there and yet wage growth did not pick up at all, they sort of sensibly said, can't be that, and sort of moved it down to 5.1, which is probably still too high. I mean, but by our estimate, there's still about 3 million workers out there who are not classified as unemployed because they're not actively searching for work, but they're likely to come back to the job market as it continues to improve, hopefully continues to improve. But I think the wage growth numbers, you know, we have about 2.2% nominal wage growth, and that really has not changed since 2011. So that to me says we still have a lot of labor market slack, and the headline unemployment rate is probably masking how far we have to go. I think we're eating away at it, which is good, those 3 million jobs we created in 2014, but we still do have quite a long way to go.
The recovery expansion period of the mid-2000s was hardly gangbusters. You know, the 2007 peak wasn't so great compared to 2000. So it's been 15 years, really, since we saw a tight labor market. What's going on? Has there been some sort of structural change? Is there a policy issue that's causing these problems? Or what's your diagnosis of why that 2000 peak just too good to be true? What do you think?
I don't think it was too good to be true. I mean, to me, the data signature on a peak that's too good to be true is it starts to unleash inflation as wages start rising, you know, well above productivity, and that didn't happen. That recovery in the 2000s, the late 90s, 2000 didn't end because of excess inflation. It ended because its foundation was a bubble. But I think we can get back to that level of demand in 2000 that leads to tight labor markets. We just need to do it with a more sustainable foundation. And I think during the 2000s, I guess in a way I'm a bit of a adherent to kind of the secular stagnation theory that Larry Summers, Paul Krugman are talking about. I think we have an economy that has more and more trouble generating sufficient demand, aggregate demand, to keep unemployment low. I think the rise in inequality is part of that. We've transferred more and more money to higher income households that have a higher propensity to save. And then in the 2000s, you know, a little bit idiosyncratic, we allowed trade deficits to balloon, which all else equal are a drain on demand. And so I think the inequality part is definitely still with us, and I do think it does mean it gets harder and harder to generate sufficient demand to really make unemployment get to really low levels. And then again, we're coming off a tremendous asset market bubble, and that definitely takes time, and it especially takes time when in its aftermath, policy is so bungled. And in the case of fiscal policy following the housing bubble, it was definitely a huge fumble.
To ask a question that's popular around DPI, I know, is it the robots? Is there something changed in the nature of machinery that we use in on the job that means we do require less human labor than ever before? Is something structural change in that sense?
I don't think so. I mean, so the clearest way, the simple version of that story would show up in the data is that there would be an increase in productivity. It would be, you know, there's plenty of demand out there. But we just need fewer and fewer workers for each given unit of output we're producing. That's what productivity is. Productivity growth has actually slowed pretty substantially over the past 6 or 7 years. It could be we're missing some output. It's just not being captured in GDP, so we're, you know, productivity looks artificially low. I don't know. I just don't see that story much. And also the other part of the sort of robots and technological change story is supposed to be, you know, there should be some workers in the economy who should actually see demand for their skills increase in response to lots of automation and technological change. People who are, you know, proficient with computers, people with, you know, advanced degrees who have the good skills. We see pretty across the board poor performance of wages, even for, you know, so-called STEM occupations, science, technology, engineering, math occupations, the occupations that have done well over the past 15 years, and even since sort of the recovery began, are definitely more financial, legal, which is, you know, not the ones that I thought were supposed to be necessarily compatible with robots. So I just don't see a lot of data out there saying that the sort of robot labor-saving technological change is really the thing that is making this recovery bad.
Well, what would improve the job market then?
I think we're still pretty demand constrained. And I think it is improving. So I don't want to say just wait, because we can do better than that. I would still like to see some real fiscal stimulus. And my preferred way would be infrastructure investments. I think most people agree we've let public investment as a share of GDP sink to really low levels, when it's pretty obvious when you just sort of look around that there's lots of ways we could profitably spend public investment dollars. I think especially in the age of climate change and global warming, you can think of all sorts of things we could be spending public money on, both for mitigation and adaptation to climate change, and it would provide jobs in the short run. So to me, you know, politics aside, the shortest route back to a really improved labor market would be a big public investment program.
That was Josh Bivens, Research Director of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. In the interview, I suggested that austere spending policies by the federal government have been intensified by austerity at the state and local level as well. He poo-pooed that somewhat, but here are the numbers. Since the beginning of 2010, GDP is up about 11%, adjusted for inflation. Federal spending is down over 10%, and state and local spending down almost 4%. The federal government's spending as a share of GDP is down by almost 2 percentage points, state and local governments by about the same. And as for the consumer spending slowdown I mentioned, yearly retail sales were growing at a 4 to 5% annual rate late last year. They're now growing under 1%. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. June 4 is Brooklyn Queens Day in New York City, a pointless holiday that's an excuse to close the schools. I thought I'd celebrate it by going out with this, Brooklyn Baby, by Lana Del Rey. Call me soft and decadent if you like. Till next week, bye.
And my boyfriend is a band. He plays guitar while I sing blues.